Vin watched Ellen scribble. Sazed sat reading, as did one of Ellen's scribes, the obligator. She eyed the man, and he shrank down a little in his seat. He knew that she'd never trusted him. Priests shouldn't be cheerful. She was excited to tell Ellen what she'd discovered about Demu, but she hesitated. There were too many people around, and she didn't really have any evidence, just her instincts. So she held herself back, looking over the stacks of books. There was a dull quiet in the room. Tyndall sat with her eyes slightly glazed. She was probably studying some ancient biography in her mind. Even Ham was reading, though he flipped from book to book, hopping topics. Vin felt as if she should be studying something, too. She thought of the notes she'd been making about the deepness and the hero of ages, but couldn't bring herself to get them out. She couldn't tell him about Demu yet, but there was something else she'd discovered.
"Elland," she said quietly, "I have something to tell you."
"Hum?"
"I heard the servants talking when Arsure and I got dinner earlier," Vin said. "Some people they know have been sick lately. A lot of them. I think that someone might be fiddling with our supplies."
"Yes," Ellen said, still writing. "I know. Several wells in the city have been poisoned."
"They have?"
He nodded. "Didn't I tell you when you checked on me earlier? That's where Ham and I were."
"You didn't tell me."
"I thought I did," Ellen said, frowning. Vin shook her head. "I apologize," he said, leaned up and kissed her, then turned back to his scribbling.
"And a kiss is supposed to make it all right," she thought sullenly, sitting back on a stack of books.
It was a silly thing. There was really no reason that Ellen should have told her so quickly. And yet the exchange left her feeling odd. Before, he would have asked her to do something about the problem. Now, he'd apparently handled it all on his own. Sazed sighed, closing his tome.
"Your Majesty, I can find no holes. I have read your laws over 6 times now."
Ellen nodded. "I feared as much. The only advantage we could gain from the law is to misinterpret it intentionally, which I will not do."
"You are a good man, Your Majesty," Sazed said. "If you had seen a hole in the law, you would have fixed it. Even if you hadn't caught the flaws, one of us would have, when you asked for our opinions."
He lets them call him Your Majesty, Vin thought. He tried to get them to stop that. Why let them use it now? Odd that Elland would finally start to think of himself as king after the throne had been taken from him.
"Wait," Tyndall said, eyes unglazing. "You read over this law before it was ratified, Sazed?"
Sazed flushed. "He did," Ellen said. "In fact, Sazed's suggestions and ideas were instrumental in helping me craft the current code."
"I see," Tyndall said through tight lips.
Ellen frowned. "Tyndall, you were not invited to this meeting. You are suffered at it. Your advice has been well appreciated, but I will not allow you to insult a friend and guest of my household, even if those insults are indirect."
"I apologize, Your Majesty."
"You will not apologize to me," Ellen said. "You will apologize to Sazed, or you will leave this conference." Tyndall sat for a moment, then she stood and left the room. Ellen didn't appear offended. He simply turned back to writing his letters.
"You didn't need to do that, Your Majesty," Sazed said. "Tyndall's opinions of me are well-founded, I think."
"I will do as I see fit, Sazed," Ellen said, still writing. "No offense, my friend, but you have a history of letting people treat you poorly. I won't stand for it in my house. By insulting your help with my laws, she insulted me as well." Sazed nodded, then reached over to pick up a new volume. Vin sat quietly.
"He's changing so quickly. How long has it been since Tyndall arrived? 2 months?"
None of the things Ellen said were that different from what he would have said before, but the way he said them was completely different. He was firm, demanding in a way that implied he expected respect.
It's the collapse of his throne. The danger of the armies, Vin thought. The pressures are forcing him to change. To either step up and lead, or get crushed. He'd known about the wells. What other things had he discovered and not told her? Elland? Vin asked. I've thought more about the deepness. That's wonderful, Vin, Elland said, smiling at her. But I really don't have time right now. Vin nodded and smiled at him. However, her thoughts were more troubled. He's not uncertain like he once was. He doesn't have to rely on people as much for support. He doesn't need me anymore. It was a foolish thought. Elland loved her. She knew that. His aptitude wouldn't make her less valuable to him, and yet she couldn't stamp out her worries. He'd left her once before, when he'd been trying to juggle the needs of his house with his love for her, and the action had nearly crushed her. What would happen if he abandoned her now? He won't, she told herself. He's a better man than that. But good men had failed relationships, didn't they? People grew apart, particularly people who were so different to begin with. Despite her self-assurances, she heard a small voice pop up in the back of her mind. It was a voice she'd thought banished, a voice she hadn't ever expected to hear again. Leave him first. Reen, her brother, seemed to whisper in her head. It will hurt less. Vin heard a rustling outside. She perked up slightly, but it had been too soft for the others to hear. She stood, walking over to the ventilation window. Going back on patrol? Elland asked. She turned, then nodded. You might want to scout out Seth's defenses at Keep Hastings, Elland said. Vin nodded again. Elland smiled at her, then turned back to his letters. Vin pulled open the window and stepped out into the night. Zane stood in the mists, feet barely resting against the stone lip running beneath the window. He stood at a skewed angle, feet against the wall, body jutting out into the night. Vin glanced to the side, noting the bit of metal that Zane was pulling against to hold himself stationary. Another feat of prowess. He smiled at her in the night. Zane? She whispered. Zane glanced upward and Vin nodded. A second later, they both landed atop Keep Venture's metal roof. Vin turned to Zane. Where have you been? He attacked. Vin jumped back in surprise as Zane spun forward, a swirling form in black, knives twinkling. She came down with her feet half off the rooftop, tense. A spar, then? She thought. Zane struck, his knife coming dangerously close to her neck as she dodged to the side. There was something different about his attacks this time. Something more dangerous. Vin cursed and pulled out her own daggers, jumping back from another attack. As she moved, Zane sliced through the air, cutting the tip off one of her mistcloak tassels. She turned to face him. He walked forward, but held no combat posture. He seemed confident, yet unconcerned, as if he were strolling up to an old friend, not entering a fight. All right, then, she thought, jumping forward, swiping with her daggers. Zane stepped forward casually, turning just slightly to the side, easily dodging one knife. He reached out, grabbing her other hand with an effortless motion, stopping its blow. Vin froze. Nobody was that good. Zane looked down at her, eyes dark. Unconcerned, unworried. He was burning Atium. Vin pulled free of his grip, jumping backward. He let her go, watching as she fell into a crouch, sweat beating on her brow. She felt a sudden sharp stab of terror, a guttural, primal feeling. She had feared this day from the moment she'd learned of Atium. It was the terror of knowing she was powerless, despite all of her skills and abilities. It was the terror of knowing she was going to die. She turned to jump away, but Zane leaped forward before she even began to move. He knew what she would do before she did herself. He grabbed her shoulder from behind,
pulling her backward, throwing her down to the rooftop. Vin slammed against the metal roofing, gasping in pain. Zane stood above her, looking down as if waiting.
"I won't be beaten this way," Vin thought with desperation. "I won't be killed like a trapped rat."
She reached and swung a knife at his leg, but it was useless. He pulled the leg back slightly, just enough, so that her swing didn't even nick the cloth of his trousers. She was like a child, being held at a distance by a much larger, more powerful foe. This was what it must be like, being a normal person trying to fight her. Zane stood in the darkness.
"What?"
she finally demanded.
"You really don't have it," he said quietly. "The Lord Ruler's Atium stash."
"No,"
she said.
"You don't have any at all," he said flatly. "I used the last bead the day I fought Set's assassins."
He stood for a moment. Then he turned, stepping away from her. Vin sat up, heart thumping, hands shaking just a bit. She forced herself to her feet, then stooped and retrieved her fallen daggers. One had cracked against the roof's copper top. Zane turned back toward her, quiet in the mists. Zane watched her in the darkness, saw her fear, yet also her determination.
"My father wants me to kill you," Zane said.
She stood, watching him, eyes still afraid. She was strong, and she repressed the fear well. The news from their spy, the words Vin had spoken while visiting Straff's tent, were all true. There was no Atium to be had in this city.
"Is that why you stayed away?" she asked.
He nodded, turning away from her.
"So?" she asked. "Why let me live?" "I'm not sure," he admitted. "I may still kill you, but I don't have to. Not to fulfill his order. I could just take you away. That would have the same effect."
He turned back toward her. She was frowning, a small, quiet figure in the mists.
"Come with me," he said. "Both of us could leave. Straff would lose his Mistborn and Elend would lose his. We could deny them both their tools. And we could be free."
She didn't respond immediately. Finally, she shook her head.
"This thing between us, Zane, it isn't what you think."
"What do you mean?" he said, stepping forward. She looked up at him.
"I love Elend, Zane. I really do."
"And you think that means you can't feel anything for me?" Zane thought. "What of that look I've seen in your eyes, that longing? No, it isn't as easy as you imply, is it?"
"It never is."
And yet what else had he expected? He turned away.
"It makes sense. That's the way it has always been."
"What is that supposed to mean?" she demanded.
"Elend."
"Kill him," God whispered. Zane squeezed his eyes shut. She would not be fooled. Not a woman who had grown up on the streets. A woman who was friends with thieves and scammers. That was the difficult part. She would need to see things that terrified Zane. She would need truth.
"Zane?"
Vin asked. She still seemed a bit shaken by his attack, but she was the type who recovered quickly.
"Can't you see the resemblance?" Zane asked, turning. "The same nose, the same slant of the face. I cut my hair shorter than he, but it has the same curl. Is it so hard to see?"
Her breath caught in her throat.
"Who else would Straff venture trust as his Mistborn?" Zane asked. "Why else would he let me get so close? Why else would he feel so comfortable letting me in on his plans?
You're his son, Vin whispered. Ellen's brother.
Zane nodded. Ellen doesn't know of me, Zane said. Ask him about our father's sexual habits sometime.
He's told me, Vin said.
Straff likes his mistresses. For more than one reason, Zane said. More women means more children. More children means more allomancers. More allomancers means more chances at having a mistborn son to be your assassin.
Breeze-blown mist washed over them. In the distance, a soldier's armor clinked as he patrolled.
While the Lord Ruler lived, I could never inherit, Zane said. You know how strict the obligators were. I grew up in the shadows, ignored. You lived on the streets. I assume that was terrible. But think of what it would be like to be a scavenger in your own home, unacknowledged by your father, treated like a beggar. Think of watching your brother, a boy your same age, growing up privileged. Think of watching his disdain for the things you longed to have. Comfort, idleness, love.
You must hate him, Vin whispered.
Hate? Zane asked. No. Why hate a man for what he is? Ellen has done nothing to me. Not directly. Besides, Straff found a reason to need me, eventually. After I snapped, and he finally got what he'd been gambling to get for the last 20 years. No, I don't hate Ellen. Sometimes, however, I do envy him. He has everything. And still, it seems to me like he doesn't appreciate it. Vin stood quietly.
I'm sorry.
Zane shook his head sharply.
Don't pity me, woman. If I were Ellen, I wouldn't be mistborn. I wouldn't understand the mists. Nor would I know what it was like to grow up alone and hated.
He turned, looking into her eyes. Don't you think a man better appreciates love when he has been forced for so long to go without? Zane turned away. Anyway, he said, I didn't come here tonight to lament my childhood. I came with a warning. Vin grew tense. A short time ago, Zane said, my father let several hundred refugees through his barricade to approach the city. You know of the Kolos army? Vin nodded. It attacked and pillaged the city of Suisna earlier. Vin felt a start of fright. Suisna was only a day away from Luthadel. The Kolos were close. The refugees came to my father for help, Zane said. He sent them on to you.
To make the people of the city more afraid, Vin said, and to provide a further drain on our resources.
Zane nodded.
I wanted to give you warning, both of the refugees and of my orders. Think about my offer, Vin. Think about this man who claims to love you. You know he doesn't understand you. If you leave, it will be better for both of you.
Vin frowned. Zane bowed his head slightly to her, then jumped into the night, pushing against the metal rooftop. She still didn't believe him about Ellen. He could see that in her eyes. Well, proof was coming. She'd soon see. She'd soon understand what Ellen Venture truly thought of her.
But I do so now. Let it be known that I, Quan, world-bringer of Terrace, am a fraud.
35. It felt like she was going to a ball again. The beautiful maroon gown would have fit in perfectly at one of the parties she had attended during the months before the collapse. The dress was untraditional, but not unfashionable. The changes simply made the dress seem distinctive. The alterations left her freer to move, let her walk more gracefully, turn more naturally. That, in turn, made her feel even more beautiful. Standing before her mirror, Vin thought of what it might have been like to wear the dress to a real ball. To be herself. Not Valette, the uncomfortable country noblewoman. Not even Vin, the ska thief. To be herself. Or at least as she could imagine herself. Confident because she accepted her place as a Mistborn. Confident because she accepted her place as the one who had struck down the Lord Ruler. Confident because she knew that the king loved her. Maybe I could be both, Vin thought, running her hands down the sides of the dress, feeling the soft satin.
You look beautiful, child, Tyndall said.
Vin turned, smiling hesitantly.
I don't have any jewelry. I gave the last of it to Ellen to help feed the refugees. It was the wrong color to go with this dress anyway.
Many women use jewelry to try and hide their own plainness, Tyndall said. You don't have that need.
The terrace woman stood with her usual posture, hands clasped before her, rings and earrings sparkling. None of her jewelry, however, had gemstones. In fact, most of it was made from simple materials. Iron, copper, pewter. Ferrochemical metals.
You haven't been in to see Ellen lately, Vin said, turning back to the mirror and using a few wooden barrettes to hold her hair back.
The king is quickly approaching the point where he no longer needs my instruction.
He's that close, then? Vin asked. To being like the men from your biographies?
Tyndall laughed.
Goodness no, child. He's quite far from that. But I said he would no longer need my instruction, Tyndall said. He is learning that he can rely only so much upon the words of others, and has reached the point where he will have to learn more for himself. You would be surprised, child, how much about being a good leader simply comes from experience.
He seems very different to me, Vin said quietly.
He is, Tyndall said, walking forward to lay a hand on Vin's shoulder. He is becoming the man that he always knew he would have to be. He just didn't know the path. Though I am hard on him, I think he would have found his way, even if I hadn't come. A man can only stumble for so long before he either falls or stands up straight.
Vin looked at her mirror self, pretty in its maroon dressings.
This is what I have become. For him.
For him? Tyndall agreed. And for yourself? This is where you were heading, before you got distracted.
Vin turned.
Are you going to come with us tonight?
Tyndall shook her head.
That is not my place. Now, go meet your king.
This time, Elland did not intend to enter his enemy's lair without a proper escort. 200 soldiers stood in the courtyard, waiting to accompany him to Set's dinner, and Ham, fully armed, was playing personal bodyguard. Spook would act as Ellen's coachman. That only left Breeze, who, understandably, was a bit nervous about the idea of going to the dinner.
"You don't have to come," Ellen told the portly man as they assembled in the venture courtyard.
"I don't," Breeze said. "Well, then, I shall remain here. Enjoy the dinner."
Ellen paused, frowning. Ham clapped Ellen on the shoulder.
"You should know better than to give that one any wiggle room, Ellen."
"Well, I meant my words," Ellen said. "We could really use a soother, but he doesn't have to come if he doesn't want to." Breeze looked relieved.
"You don't even feel a bit guilty, do you?" Ham asked.
"Guilty?"
Breeze asked, hand resting on his cane.
"My dear Hammond, have you ever known me to express such a dreary and uninspired emotion? Besides, I have a feeling Set will be more amiable without me around."
"He's probably right," Ellen thought as his coach pulled up.
Elland, Ham said, don't you think bringing 200 soldiers with us is, well, a little obvious?
Set is the one who said we should be honest with our threats, Elland said. Well, I'd say 200 men is on the conservative side of how well I trust the man. He'll still have us outnumbered 5-1.
But you'll have a Mistborn sitting a few seats from him, a soft voice said from behind.
Elland turned, smiling at Vin. How can you possibly move so quietly in a dress like that?
I've been practicing, she said, taking his arm.
Thing is, she probably has, he thought, inhaling her perfume, imagining Vin creeping through the palace hallways in a massive ball gown.
Well, we should get moving, Ham said.
He gestured for Vin and Elland to enter the carriage, and they left Breeze behind on the palace steps. After a year of passing Keep Hasting in the night, its windows darkened, it felt right to see them glowing again.
You know, Elland said from beside her, we never did get to attend a ball together.
Vin turned from her contemplation of the approaching keep. Around her, the carriage bounced along to the sound of several hundred tromping feet, the evening just beginning to grow dark.
We met up several times at the balls, Elland continued, but we never officially attended one together. I never got the chance to pick you up in my carriage.
Is that really so important? Vin asked.
Elland shrugged. It's all part of the experience, or it was. There was a comfortable formality to it all. The gentleman arriving to accompany the lady, then everyone watching you enter and evaluating how you look together. I did it dozens of times with dozens of women, but never with the one that would have made the experience special.
Vin smiled.
Do you think we'll ever have balls again?
I don't know, Vin. Even if we survive all of this. Well, could you dance while so many people starved?
He was probably thinking about the hundreds of refugees, wearied from their travels, stripped of all food and equipment by Straff's soldiers, huddled together in the warehouse Elland had found for them.
You danced before, she thought. People starved then, too.
But that was a different time. Elland hadn't been king then. In fact, as she thought about it, he had never actually danced at those balls. He had studied and met with his friends, planning how he could make a better place out of the final empire.
There has to be a way to have both, Vin said. Maybe we could throw balls and ask the nobility who came to donate money to help feed the people.
Elland smiled. We'd probably spend twice as much on the party as we got in donations.
And the money we spent would go to Ska merchants.
Elland paused thoughtfully, and Vin smirked to herself.
Odd that I would end up with the only frugal nobleman in the city.
What a pair they were. A Mistborn who felt guilty wasting coins to jump, and a nobleman who thought balls were too expensive. It was a wonder that Doxin could pry enough money out of them to keep the city running.
We'll worry about that later, Elland said as the Hasting gates opened, revealing a field of soldiers at attention.
You can bring your soldiers if you want, the display seemed to say. I've got more.
In reality, they were entering a strange allegory of Luthadel itself. Elland's 200 were now surrounded by Set's 1,000, which in turn were surrounded by Luthadel's 20,000. The city, of course, was then surrounded by nearly 100,000 troops on the outside. Layer upon layer of soldiers, all tensely waiting for a fight. Thoughts of balls and parties fled her mind. Set did not greet them at the door. That duty was performed by a soldier in a simple uniform.
"Your soldiers can remain here," the man said as they entered the main entryway.
Once, the large, pillared room had been draped in fine rugs and wall hangings, but Elland had taken those to fund his government. Set, obviously, hadn't brought replacements, and that left the inside of the keep feeling austere, like a battlefront fortress, rather than a mansion. Elland turned, waving to Demu, and the captain ordered his men to wait indoors. Vin stood for a moment, consciously keeping herself from shooting a glare at Demu.
If he was the Chandra, as her instincts warned, then it was dangerous to have him too close. Part of her itched to simply throw him into a dungeon. And yet a Chandra couldn't hurt humans, so he wasn't a direct threat. He was simply there to relay information. Plus, he'd already know their most sensitive secrets. There was little point in striking now, playing her hand so quickly. If she waited, saw where he went when he slipped out of the city, then maybe she could find out which army, or sect in the city, he was reporting to. Learn what information he had betrayed. And so she stayed her hand, waiting. The time to strike would come. Ham and Damu arranged their men, and then a smaller honor guard, including Ham, Spook, and Damu, gathered to stay with Vin and Elland. Elland nodded to Set's man, and the soldier led them down a side passageway. "We're not heading for the lifts," Vin thought. The Hastings ballroom was at the very top of the keep's central tower. The times she had attended balls in the structure, she had been taken to the top on one of four human-drawn lifts. Either Hastings didn't want to waste the manpower, or... He picked the tallest keep in the city, Vin thought. The one with the fewest windows as well. If Set pulled all the lifts to the top, it would be very difficult for an invading force to claim the keep. Fortunately, it didn't appear that they would have to go all the way to the top this evening. After they climbed two flights in a twisting stone stairwell, Vin having to pull her dress in at the sides to keep from brushing against the stones, their guide led them out into a large circular room with stained glass windows running around the entire perimeter, broken only by columns to support the ceiling. The single room was nearly as wide around as the tower itself. A secondary ballroom, perhaps? Vin wondered, taking in the beauty. The glass wasn't lit, though she suspected that there were clefts for limelights on the outside. Set didn't appear to care about such things. He had set up a large table in the very center of the room, and sat at its head. He was already eating.
"You're late," he called out to Elland. "So I started without you."
Elland frowned. To this, Set laughed a full bellow, holding up a drumstick.
"You seem more aghast at my breach of etiquette than you do about the fact that I brought an army to conquer you, boy. But I suppose that's Luthadel. Sit down before I eat this all myself."
Elland held out an arm for Vin, leading her to the table. Spook took up position near the stairwell, his tin eyes ears listening for danger. Ham led their 10 men to a position from which they could watch the only entrances to the room, the entry from the stairs and the door the serving staff used. Set ignored the soldiers. He had a group of his own bodyguards standing near the wall on the other side of the room, but he seemed unconcerned that Ham's troop had them slightly outnumbered. His son, the young man who had attended him at the assembly meeting, stood at his side, waiting quietly.
"One of the two has to be Mistborn," Vin thought. "And I still think it is Set."
Elland seated her, then took a chair next to her, both of them sitting directly across from Set. He barely paused in his eating as the servers brought Vin's and Elland's dishes.
"Drumsticks," Vin thought, "and vegetables and gravy. He wants this to be a messy meal. He wants to make Elland uncomfortable."
Elland didn't start on his food immediately. He sat watching Set, his expression thoughtful.
"Damn," Set said, "this is good food. You have no idea how hard it is to get proper meals when traveling."
"Why did you want to speak with me?" Elland asked. "You know I won't be convinced to vote for you." Set shrugged.
"I thought it might be interesting."
"Is this about your daughter?" Elland asked.
"Lord Ruler, no," Set said with a laugh. "Keep the silly thing if you want. The day she ran off was one of the few joys I've had this last month."
"And if I threaten to harm her?" Elland asked.
"You won't," Set said.
"You're certain?" Set smiled through his thick beard, leaning toward Elland.
"I know you, Venture. I'd been watching you, studying you for months. And then you were kind enough to send one of your friends to spy on me. I learned a lot about you from him.
Elland looked troubled. Set laughed.
Honestly, you didn't think I'd recognize one of the survivor's own crew members? You Lúthadel noblemen must assume that everyone outside the city is a damn fool.
And yet you listened to Breeze, Elland said.
You let him join you, listened to his advice. And then you only chased him away when you found him being intimate with your daughter, the one you claimed to have no affection for.
Is that why he told you he left the camp?
Set asked, laughing.
Because I caught him with Alrianne? Goodness, what do I care if the girl seduced him?
You think she seduced him? Vin asked.
Of course, Set said. Honestly, I only spent a few weeks with him, and even I know how useless he is with women.
Elland was taking all this in stride. He watched Set with narrow, discerning eyes.
So why did you chase him away?
Set leaned back.
I tried to turn him. He refused. I figured killing him would be preferable to letting him return to you. But he's remarkably agile for a man his size.
If Set really is Mistborn, there's no way Breeze got away without Set letting him, Vin thought.
So you see, Venture, Set said, I know you. I know you better, perhaps, than you know yourself. For I know what your friends think of you. It takes a pretty extraordinary man to earn the loyalty of a weasel like Breeze.
So you think I won't harm your daughter, Elland said.
I know you won't, Set said. You're honest. I happen to like that about you. Unfortunately, honesty is very easy to exploit. I knew, for instance, that you'd admit Breeze was soothing that crowd.
Set shook his head.
Honest men weren't meant to be kings, lad. It's a damn shame, but it's true. That's why I have to take the throne from you.
Elland was silent for a moment. Finally, he looked to Vin. She took his plate, sniffing it with an allomancer's senses.
Set laughed. Think I'd poison you?
No, actually, Elland said as Vin set the plate down. She wasn't as good as some, but she'd learned the obvious sense.
You wouldn't use poison, Elland said. That isn't your way. You seem to be a rather honest man yourself. I'm just blunt, Set said. There's a difference.
I haven't heard you tell a lie yet.
That's because you don't know me well enough to discern the lies, Set said.
He held up several grease-stained fingers.
I've already told you three lies tonight, lad. Good luck guessing which ones they were.
Elland paused, studying Set.
You're playing with me. Of course I am, Set said. Don't you see, boy? This is why you shouldn't be king. Leave the job to men who understand their own corruption. Don't let it destroy you.
Why do you care? Elland asked.
Because I'd rather not kill you, Set said.
Then don't.
Set shook his head.
That isn't how all this works, lad. If there's an opportunity to stabilize your power or to get more power, you'd damned well better take it. And I will.
The table fell silent again. Set eyed Vin.
No comments from the Mistborn?
You swear a lot, Vin said. You're not supposed to do that in front of ladies. Set laughed.
That's the funny thing about Lúthadel, lass. They're all so concerned about doing what is proper when people can see them. But at the same time, they find nothing wrong with going and raping a couple of Ska women when the party is through. At least I swear to your face.
Elland still hadn't touched his food. What will happen if you win the vote for the throne? Set shrugged.
Honest answer?
Always.
First thing, I'd have you assassinated, Set said. Can't have old kings sticking around.
And if I step down, Elland said, withdraw from the vote?
Step down, Set said. Vote for me and then leave town and I'll let you live.
And the assembly? Elland asked.
Dissolved, Set said. They're a liability. Anytime you give a committee power, you just end up with confusion.
The Assembly gives the people power, Ellen said. That's what a government should provide. Surprisingly, Set didn't laugh at that comment. Instead, he leaned in again, setting one arm on the table, discarding a half-eaten drumstick.
That's the thing, boy. Letting the people rule themselves is fine when everything is bright and happy. But what about when you have two armies facing you? What about when there's a band of insane kolos destroying villages on your frontier? Those aren't the times when you can afford to have an assembly around to depose you.
Set shook his head.
The price is too high. When you can't have both freedom and safety, boy, which do you choose?
Elland was silent. I make my own choice, he finally said, and I leave the others to make their own as well.
Set smiled as if he'd expected such a reply. He started in on another drumstick.
Let's say I leave, Elland said, and let's say you do get the throne, protect the city and dissolve the assembly.
What then? What are the people?
What do you care?
You need ask, Elland said. I thought you understood me.
Set smiled.
I put the ska back to work in the way the Lord Ruler did. No pay, no emancipated peasant class.
I can't accept that, Ellen said.
Why not? Set said. It's what they want. You gave them a choice, and they chose to throw you out. Now they're going to choose to put me on the throne. They know that the Lord Ruler's way was the best. One group must rule and another must serve. Someone has to grow the food and work the forges, boy.
Perhaps, Ellen said. But you're wrong about one thing.
And what is that?
They're not going to vote for you, Ellen said, standing. They're going to choose me. Faced with the choice between freedom and slavery, they will choose freedom. The men of the Assembly are the finest of this city, and they will make the best choice for its people.
Set paused, then he laughed.
The best thing about you, lad, is that you can say that and sound serious.
I'm leaving, Set, Ellen said, nodding to Vin.
Oh, sit down, Venture, Set said, waving toward Ellen's chair. Don't act indignant because I'm being honest with you. We still have things to discuss.
Such as? Ellen asked.
Atium, Set said.
Ellen stood for a moment, apparently forcing down his annoyance. When Set didn't speak immediately, Ellen finally sat and began to eat. Vin just picked quietly at her food. As she did, however, she studied the faces of Set's soldiers and servants. There were bound to be allomancers mixed among them. Finding out how many could give Ellen an advantage.
"Your people are starving," Set said. "And if my spies are worth their coin, you just got another influx of mouths. You can't last much longer under this siege."
"And?" Ellen asked.
"I have food," Set said. "A lot of it. More than my army needs. Canned goods, packed with the new method the Lord Ruler developed. Long-lasting, no spoilage. Really a marvel of technology. I'd be willing to trade you some of them."
Ellen paused, fork halfway to his mouth. Then he lowered it and laughed.
"You still think I have the Lord Ruler's Atium?"
"Of course you have it," Set said, frowning. "Where else would it be?"
Ellen shook his head, taking a bite of gravy-drenched potato.
"Not here, for certain." "But rumors," Set said.
"Breeze spread those rumors," Ellen said. "I thought you'd figured out why he joined your group. He wanted you to come to Luthadel so that you'd stop Straff from taking the city." "But Breeze did everything he could to keep me from coming here," Set said. "He downplayed the rumors. He tried to distract me. He..."
Set trailed off,
then bellowed a laugh.
I thought he was just there to spy. It seems we both underestimated each other.
My people could still use that food, Ellen said.
And they'll have it, assuming I become king.
They're starving now, Ellen said.
And their suffering will be your burden, Set said, his face growing hard. I can see that you have judged me, Ellen Venture. You think me a good man. You're wrong. Honesty does not make a man less of a tyrant. I slaughtered thousands to secure my rule. I put burdens on the Scar that make even the Lord Ruler's hand seem pleasant. I made certain that I stayed in power. I will do the same here.
The men fell silent. Ellen ate, but Vin only mixed her food around. If she had missed a poison, she wanted one of them to remain alert. She still wanted to find those allomancers, and there was only one way to be certain. She turned off her copper, then burned bronze. There was no copper cloud burning. Set apparently didn't care if someone recognized his men as allomancers. Two of his men were burning pewter. Neither, however, were soldiers. Both were pretending to be members of the serving staff who were bringing meals. There was also a tin eye pulsing in the other room, listening. Why hide thugs as servants, then use no copper to hide their pulses? In addition, there were no soothers or rioters. Nobody was trying to influence Ellen's emotions. Neither Set nor his youthful attendant were burning any metals. Either they weren't actually allomancers, or they feared exposing themselves. Just to be certain, Vin flared her bronze, seeking to pierce any hidden copper clouds that might be nearby. She could see Set putting out some obvious allomancers as a distraction, then hiding the others inside a cloud. She found nothing. Finally satisfied, she returned to picking at her meal.
How many times has this ability of mine, the ability to pierce copper clouds, proven useful?
She'd forgotten what it was like to be blocked from sensing allomantic pulses. This one little ability, simple though it seemed, provided an enormous advantage. And the Lord Ruler and his Inquisitors had probably been able to do it from the beginning. What other tricks was she missing? What other secrets had died with the Lord Ruler?
He knew the truth about the deepness, Vin thought. He must have. He tried to warn us at the end.
Ellen and Set were talking again. Why couldn't she focus on the problems of the city?
So you don't have any ATM at all? Set said.
None that we're willing to sell, Ellen said.
You've searched the city, Set asked. A dozen times. The statues, Set said. Perhaps the Lord Ruler hid the metal by melting it down, then building things out of it.
Ellen shook his head. We thought of that. The statues aren't ATM, and they aren't hollow either. That would have been a good place to hide metal from Allomancer eyes. We thought maybe that it would be hidden in the palace somewhere, but even the spires are simple iron.
Caves, tunnels?
None that we can find, Ellen said. We've had Allomancers patrol, searching for large sources of metals. We've done everything we can think of, Set, short of tearing holes in the ground. Trust me, we've been working on this problem for a while.
Set nodded, sighing.
So I suppose holding you for ransom would be pointless.
Ellen smiled. I'm not even king, Set. The only thing you'd do is make the assembly less likely to vote for you.
Set laughed.
Suppose I'll have to let you go, then. Alendi was never the hero of ages. At best, I have amplified his virtues, creating a hero where there was none. At worst, I fear that all we believe may have been corrupted.
36. Once this warehouse had held swords and armor, scattered across its floor in heaps like mythical treasure.
Sazed remembered walking through it, marveling at the preparations Kelsier had made, without alerting any of his crew members. Those weapons had armed the rebellion on the eve of the survivor's own death, letting it take the city. Those weapons were now stored in lockers and armories. In their place, a desperate, beaten people huddled in what blankets they could find. There were very few men, none of fighting quality. Straff had pressed those into his army. These others, the weak, the sickly, the wounded, he had allowed to Luthadel, knowing that Elend wouldn't turn them away. Sazed moved among them, offering what comfort he could. They had no furniture, and even changes of clothing were becoming scarce in the city. The merchants, realizing that warmth would be a premium for the upcoming winter, had begun raising prices on all their wares, not just foodstuffs. Sazed knelt beside a crying woman.
"Peace, Janadir," he said, his copper mind reminding him of her name. She shook her head. She had lost 3 children in the Koloss attack, 2 more in the flight to Luthadel. Now the final one, the babe she had carried the entire way, was sick. Sazed took the child from her arms, carefully studying his symptoms. Little had changed from the day before.
"Is there hope, Master Terrasman?" Janadir asked.
Sazed glanced down at the thin, glassy-eyed baby. The chances were not good. How could he tell her such a thing?
"As long as he breathes, there is hope, dear woman," Sazed said. "I will ask the king to increase your portion of food. You need strength to give suck. You must keep him warm. Stay near the fires, and use a damp cloth to drip water in his mouth, even when he is not eating. He has great need of liquids."
Janadir nodded dully, taking the baby back. How Sazed wished he could give her more. 12 different religions passed through his mind. He had spent his entire life trying to encourage people to believe in something other than the Lord Ruler. Yet for some reason, at this moment, he found it difficult to preach one of them to Janadir. It had been different before the collapse. Each time he'd spoken of a religion, Sazed had felt a subtle sense of rebellion. Even if people hadn't accepted the things he taught, and they rarely had, his words had reminded them that there had once been beliefs other than the doctrines of the Steel Ministry. Now there was nothing to rebel against. In the face of the terrible grief he saw in Janadir's eyes, he found it difficult to speak of religions long dead, gods long forgotten. Esoterica would not ease this woman's pain. Sazed stood, moving on to the next group of people.
"Sazed?"
Sazed turned. He hadn't noticed Tyndwill entering the warehouse. The doors of the large structure were closed against approaching night, and the fire pits gave an inconsistent light. Holes had been knocked in the roof to let out the smoke. If one looked up, trails of mist could be seen creeping into the room, though they evaporated before they reached halfway to the floor. The refugees didn't often look up.
"You've been here nearly all day," Tyndwill said.
The room was remarkably quiet, considering its occupancy. Fires crackled, and people lay silent in their pain or numbness.
"There are many wounded here," Sazed said. "I am the best one to look after them, I think. I am not alone. The king has sent others, and Lord Breeze is here, soothing the people's despair."
Sazed nodded to the side where Breeze sat in a chair, ostensibly reading a book. He looked terribly out of place in the room, wearing his fine 3-piece suit. Yet his mere presence said something remarkable in Sazed's estimation.
"These poor people," Sazed thought. "Their lives were terrible under the Lord Ruler. Now even what little they had has been taken from them."
And they were only a tiny number. 400 compared with the hundreds of thousands who still lived in Luthadel. What would happen when the final stores of food ran out? Rumors were already abroad regarding the poisoned wells, and Sazed had just heard that some of their stored food had been sabotaged as well. What would happen to these people? How long could the siege continue? In fact, what would happen when the siege ended? What would happen when the armies finally began to attack and pillage? What destruction, what grief would the soldiers cause in searching for hidden Atium?
You do care for them, Tyndall said quietly, stepping up.
Sazed turned toward her. Then he looked down.
Not as much as I should, perhaps.
No, Tyndall said.
I can see it. You confuse me, Sazed. I seem to have a talent in that area. You look tired. Where is your bronze mind?
Suddenly, Sazed felt the fatigue. He'd been ignoring it, but her words seemed to bring it in like a wave rolling over him. He sighed.
I used most of my wakefulness in my run to Luthadel. I was so eager to get here.
His studies had languished recently. With the problems in the city and the arrival of the refugees, he hadn't had much time. Besides, he had already transcribed the rubbing. Further work would require detailed cross-referencing to other works, searching for clues. He probably wouldn't even have time to... He frowned, noting the odd look in Tyndall's eyes.
All right, she said, sighing. Show me. Show you? Whatever it was you found, she said. The discovery that prompted you to run across two dominances. Show it to me.
Suddenly, everything seemed to lighten. His fatigue, his worry, even his sorrow.
I would love to, he said quietly.
Another job well done, Breeze thought,
congratulating himself as he watched the two terracemen leave the warehouse. Most people, even noblemen, misunderstood soothing. They thought of it as some kind of mind control, and even those who knew more presumed that soothing was an invasive, terrible thing. Breeze had never seen it that way. Soothing wasn't invasive. If it was, then ordinary interaction with another person was comparably invasive. Soothing, when done right, was no more a violation of another person than it was for a woman to wear a low-cut gown or speak in a commanding voice. All three produced common, understandable, and, most important, natural reactions in people. Take Sazed, for example. Was it invasive to make the man less fatigued, so he could better go about his ministrations? Was it wrong to soothe away his pain, just a bit, thereby making him better able to cope with the suffering? Tyndall was an even better example. Perhaps some would call Breeze a meddler for soothing her sense of responsibility and her disappointment when she saw Sazed. But Breeze had not created the emotions that the disappointment had been overshadowing. Emotions like curiosity, respect, love. No, if soothing were simple mind control, Tyndall would have turned away from Sazed as soon as the two left Breeze's area of influence. But Breeze knew that she wouldn't. A crucial decision had been made, and Breeze had not made that decision for her. The moment had been building for weeks. It would have occurred with or without Breeze. He had just helped it happen sooner. Smiling to himself, Breeze checked his pocket watch. He still had a few more minutes, and he settled back in his chair, sending out a general soothing wave, lessening people's grief and pain. Focusing on so many at once, he couldn't be very specific. Some would find themselves made a little emotionally numb as he pushed too strongly against them. But it would be good for the group as a whole. He didn't read his book. In truth, he couldn't understand how Ellen and the rest spent so much time with them. Dreadfully boring things. Breeze could only see himself reading if there were no people around. Instead, he went back to what he'd been doing before Sazed had drawn his attention. He studied the refugees, trying to decide what each one was feeling. This was the other great misunderstanding about soothing. Allomancy wasn't nearly as important as observational talent. True, having a subtle touch certainly helped. However, soothing didn't give an allomancer the ability to know someone's feelings.
Those Breeze had to guess on his own. It all came back to what was natural. Even the most inexperienced Ska would realize they were being soothed if unexpected emotions began bouncing around inside of them. True subtlety in soothing was about encouraging natural emotions, all done by carefully making the right other emotions less powerful. People were a patchwork of feelings. Usually what they thought they were feeling at the moment only related to which emotions were currently most dominant within them. The careful soother saw what was beneath the surface. He understood what a man was feeling even when that man himself didn't understand or acknowledge those emotions. Such was the case with Sazed and Tyndall.
Odd pair, that one, Breeze thought to himself, idly soothing one of the Ska to make him more relaxed as he tried to sleep. The rest of the crew is convinced that those two are enemies, but hatred rarely creates that measure of bitterness and frustration. Now those two emotions come from an entirely different set of problems. Of course, isn't Sazed supposed to be a eunuch? I wonder how this all came about.
His speculations trailed off as the warehouse doors opened. Elland walked in, Ham unfortunately accompanying him. Elland was wearing one of his white uniforms, complete with white gloves and a sword. The white was an important symbol. With all of the ash and soot in the city, a man in white was quite striking. Elland's uniforms had to be crafted of special fabrics designed to be resistant to ash, and they still had to be scrubbed every day. The effect was worth the effort. Breeze immediately picked at Ellen's emotions, making the man less tired, less uncertain, though the second was becoming almost unnecessary. That was partially the Terrace Woman's doing. Breeze had been impressed with her ability to change how people felt, considering her lack of allomancy. Breeze left Ellen's emotions of disgust and pity. Both were appropriate considering the environment. He did, however, give Ham a nudge to make him less argumentative. Breeze wasn't in a mood to deal with the man's prattlings at the moment. He stood as the two men approached. People perked up as they saw Elland, his presence somehow bringing them a hope that Breeze couldn't emulate with allomancy. They whispered, calling Elland king.
"Breeze," Elland said, nodding. "Is Sazed here?" "He just left, I'm afraid," Breeze said.
Elland seemed distracted.
"Oh, well," he said, "I'll find him later."
Elland looked around the room, lips downturned.
"Ham, tomorrow I want you to round up the clothing merchants on Kenton Street and bring them here to see this."
"They might not like that, Elland," Ham said.
"I hope they don't," Elland said. "But we'll see how they feel about their prices once they visit this room. I can understand food's expense, considering its scarcity. However, there is no reason but greed to deny the people clothing."
Ham nodded, but Breeze could see the reticence in his posture. Did the others realize how strangely non-confrontational Ham was? He liked to argue with friends, but he rarely actually came to any conclusions in his philosophizing. Plus, he absolutely hated fighting with strangers. Breeze had always found that an odd attribute in one who was hired, essentially, to hit people. He gave Ham a bit of soothing to make him less worried about confronting the merchants.
"You aren't going to stay here all night, are you, Breeze?" Elland asked.
"Lord Ruler, no," Breeze said. "My dear man, you're lucky you managed to get me to come at all. Honestly, this is no place for a gentleman. The dirt, the depressing atmosphere... and that's not even making mention of the smell."
Ham frowned.
"Breeze, someday you're going to have to learn to think about other people."
"As long as I can think about them from a distance, Hammond, I shall be happy to engage in the activity."
Ham shook his head.
"You're hopeless."
"Are you heading back to the palace, then?" Elland asked.
"Yes, actually," Breeze said, checking his pocket watch.
"Do you need a ride?"
"I brought my own carriage," Breeze said.
Elland nodded, then turned to Ham, and the two retreated the way they had come, talking about Elland's next meeting with one of the other assemblymen. Breeze wandered into the palace a short time later. He nodded to the door guards, soothing away their mental fatigue. They perked up in response, watching the mists with renewed vigilance. It wouldn't last long, but touches like that were second nature to Breeze. It was getting late, and few people were in the hallways. He made his way through the kitchens, nudging the scullery maids to make them more chatty. It would make their cleaning pass more quickly. Beyond the kitchens, he found a small stone room, lit by a couple of plain lamps, set with a small table. It was one of the palace's booth-like solitary dining rooms. Clubs sat in one corner of the booth, gimped legs stretched out on the bench. He eyed Breeze with a scowl.
"You're late."
"You're early," Breeze said, sliding into the bench across from Clubs.
"Same thing," Clubs grumbled.
There was a second cup on the table, along with a bottle of wine. Breeze unbuttoned his vest, sighed quietly, and poured himself a cup as he leaned back with his legs up on his bench. Clubs sipped his wine.
"You have your cloud up?" Breeze asked. "Around you," Clubs said. "Always."
Breeze smiled, taking a sip and relaxed. Though he rarely had opportunities to use his powers anymore, Clubs was a smoker. When he was burning copper, every Allomancer's abilities were invisible to those burning bronze. But more important, at least to Breeze, burning copper made Clubs immune to any form of emotional Allomancy.
"Don't see why that makes you so happy," Clubs said. "I thought you liked playing with emotions."
"I do," Breeze said.
"Then why come drink with me every night?" Clubs asked.
"You mind the company?"
Clubs didn't answer. That was pretty much his way of saying he didn't mind. Breeze eyed the grumpy general. Most of the other crew members stayed away from Clubs. Kelsier had brought him in at the last moment since the copper cloud they usually used had died.
"Do you know what it's like, Clubs?" Breeze asked. "Being a soother?"
"No."
"It gives you remarkable control. It's a wonderful feeling, being able to influence those around you, always feeling like you have a handle on how people will react."
"Sounds delightful," Clubs said flatly.
"And yet, it does things to you. I spend most of my time watching people, tweaking, nudging, and soothing. That's changed me. I don't look at people the same way. It's hard to just be friends with someone when you see them as something to be influenced and changed."
Clubs grunted.
"So that's why we never used to see you with women."
Breeze nodded.
"I can't help it anymore. I always touch the emotions of everyone around me. And so when a woman comes to love me..."
He liked to think he wasn't invasive. Yet how could he trust anyone who said they loved him? Was it he or his Allomancy that they responded to? Clubs filled his cup.
"You're a lot sillier than you act."
Breeze smiled. Clubs was one of the few people who was completely immune to his touch. Emotional Allomancy wouldn't work on him, and he was always completely forthcoming with his emotions. Everything made him grumpy. Manipulating him through non-Allomantic means had proven to be a fruitless waste of time. Breeze regarded his wine.
"The amusing thing is, you almost didn't join the crew because of me."
"Damn soothers," Clubs muttered.
"But you're immune to us."
"To your Allomancy, maybe," Clubs said. "But that isn't the only way you people do things. A man always has to watch himself around soothers."
"Then why let me join you every evening for wine?"
Clubs was silent for a moment, and Breeze almost thought he wasn't going to respond. Finally, Clubs muttered,
"You're not as bad as most."
Breeze took a gulp of wine.
"That is as honest a compliment as I think I've ever received."
"Don't let it ruin you," Clubs said.
"Oh, I think I'm too late for ruining," Breeze said, topping off his cup. "This crew, Kel's plan, has already done a thorough job of that."
Clubs nodded in agreement.
"What happened to us Clubs?" Breeze asked. "I joined Kel for the challenge. I never did know why you joined."
"Money," Breeze nodded.
"His plan fell apart, his army got destroyed, and we stayed. Then he died, and we still stayed. This blasted kingdom of Ellen's is doomed, you know."
"We won't last another month," Club said. It wasn't idle pessimism. Breeze knew people well enough to tell when they were serious.
"And yet here we are," Breeze said. "I spent all day making Scar feel better about the fact that their families had been slaughtered. You spent all day training soldiers that, with or without your help, will barely last a few heartbeats against a determined foe. We follow a boy of a king who doesn't seem to have a shade of a clue just how bad his predicament is. Why?"
Clubs shook his head.
"Kelsier gave us a city, made us think we were responsible for protecting it."
"But we aren't that kind of people," Breeze said. "We're thieves and scammers. We shouldn't care. I mean, I've gotten so bad that I sue the scullery maids so that they'll have a happier time at work. I might as well start dressing in pink and carrying around flowers. I could probably make quite a bundle at weddings."
Clubs snorted. Then he raised his cup.
"To the survivor," he said. "May he be damned for knowing us better than we knew ourselves."
Breeze raised his own cup.
"Damn him," he agreed quietly.
The two fell silent. Talking to Clubs tended to turn into, well, not talking.